Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. Actually, it makes me feel kind of weird because I try really hard to avoid it, but it seems that anytime like I have a new female on the show, I only have females on the show.
Gotcha.
And I'm like, why does it always work out this way? Surely, you know, I don't think only women want to read Ender's Game. Actually, quite the contrary. I mean, with the whole kind of military subtleness and stuff in there. Well, not subtleness, but blatantness in there.
Yeah.
I figured it would be. But I needed people who read, and apparently men don't read.
Some do. Griffin reads.
Allegedly. Jeez. Have you ever seen Griffin read?
I have, but not Griffin used book? To live with me.
Okay.
Like, he used to rent our room, so I have seen him read. But he does read a lot of comic books, so...
Yeah, it's all pictures. Yeah. Well, we were just watching something where it was like, comic books are the biggest lie, because they give you the promise of not actually having to read, but it's actually more words than you would ever have imagined.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
And if you want to, you can come just a little bit closer. Okay. If you're going to recline. I know the fire is right there. We've got it going.
I know.
Going.
I'm like, trying to get closer.
It's kind of cozy. It gets kind of cold down here, so I wanted to make sure that,
yeah,
you know, we weren't freezing you out. You weren't thinking it was like some kind of torture.
I'm never going back to that.
Never going to that house. It's too cold. Our house is pretty cold, too.
What's like I said, it's pretty decent upstairs. It's just... down here we're not light people, so we don't really have the windows open. There's no sunlight that gets in if I can help it, so
that's fine. My husband's have you met my husband?
I have.
Okay,
this is actually something we were trying to figure out earlier, because I mean, I feel like you guys were at Spring Garden when we were at Spring Garden.
We were
for some point in time, but I think it was at the point in time when I was checking out mentally a lot.
Yeah.
So I felt bad because everybody's like, oh, yeah, y'all were all there together. And I was like, oh, gosh, people I don't know. Because I hate that. I hate, I like connecting with people so much that
I felt
guilty. Yeah. But
no need to feel guilty.
Oh, well, it's too late. You should have told me that like a year ago.
Actually, well, I remember going there with you guys because we were in small group together. Yeah. And also because TJ spoke on a Sunday after we spoke. I don't know if you remember that.
I didn't realize it was right after you guys.
But I always remember that about TJ, but apparently nobody else recalls, like, us speaking or TJ speaking that day.
I remember you guys speaking, but I just don't think I remembered it was on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think any time we spoke, there it was all about me. I was like, did anything happen else today? No, just me talking. Just checking. Usually anytime we both speak in front of people, I'm very self-conscious about not speaking over Laura.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, don't interrupt her. You know, don't contradict anything she says. Don't correct anything she says. You know, because my personality my personality is very, you know, very specific. You know, so it's probably like, I'm speaking, I'm done. Laura is explaining this thing. Okay, and just to make sure that I don't say it wrong, Arian.
Yes.
Okay.
You got it.
Arian. Yeah.
Just think A R I A N.
Air.
I thought we were trying to avoid that.
It's okay. A little bit. You don't know how many times I've heard it.
A little bit.
But for pronunciation's sake, that's how you say it.
All right. So, you're good?
Mm-hmm. I guess I am.
You're good? I guess we'll find out here in a second.
Yeah. Yeah. This remains to be seen.
Okay. Well, since everyone appears to be ready, welcome to Real World Theology, episode 12. I am your host, Fizz. On this episode, we're going to be taking apart the recent film, Ender's Game. The film is based on a 1985 military science fiction novel by Orson Scott Card. Set in Earth's future, the film presents an imperiled mankind after two conflicts with the Formix, or buggers, an insectoid alien species. In preparation for an anticipated third invasion, children, including our protagonist, Ender Wiggin, are trained at a very young age through increasingly difficult games, including some in zero gravity, where Ender's tactical genius is revealed. The book itself has also become suggested reading for many military organizations, including the United States Marine Corps. So, with that, to our panel. My guests this week are blogger and novelist Laura Fissel. Hello.
Hello.
And we are very lucky to have first-time guest to the podcast, librarian, book reviewer, and thus a super reader, Arian Jones. Welcome, ladies.
Hello.
Let's see. So here we are, nearly 30 years later, and after Orson Scott Card himself doubted that this movie could ever be made, watching the story unfold before our eyes on screen, the movie itself has drawn the finest of crowds by bringing on Harrison Ford, Ben Kingsley, Viola Davis, and the well-cast Asa Butterfield. Asa Butterfield?
Asa
Butterfield. Laura says Asa. We're going to go with that. boasting impressive special effects as well, the movie tries to be everything we could hope for from an adaptation. While there was much to do about Orson Scott Card's personal beliefs on many current hot-button social topics, there were many people who couldn't be detracted. In the actual film itself, though, we don't get every subplot from the book, which is sad and from my point of view, but we still have a plethora of narrative topics to choose from when it comes to examining the film, from self-preservation to Christ imagery to a certain degree, and to the end game of life itself, if we take it out to the meta, which I hope we do. So, as we do every episode, we start with the basic. Did you enjoy the film? Any takers? Y'all can draw straws.
I will go. I did not really enjoy the film very much, but I also did not really enjoy the book very much, which surprised me, because I have enjoyed science fiction, dystopian, that type of genre more so recently.
Can you give some examples?
So dystopian-wise, like Hunger Games, mm-hmm. Divergent, that type of stuff. And I'd never been into those type of books before. And so this came, the movie was getting ready to come out, and I was like, I need to read this because Orson Scott Card is from Greensboro. And so I read it and had a hard time just enjoying it. And I was speaking to Laura previously about how I just think it was the space element, too, that I did not really like. And as far as the movie goes, I think it was a decent adaptation. I did like just the graphics and the movie in general, but I felt like it left out a lot. But I also don't know how it could have been any longer. So, yeah, that's just kind of where I am with
the movie. That's cool.
I think I've been struggling with there's like part of me that liked some elements of it and really disliked some elements. Like, I'm really polarized in that. I'm not in the middle necessarily. Let's just say I really liked the end. I liked like the last half, mm-hmm. and the first half I really had a hard time getting into. But I think what I've decided is that I do like the movie, not more than the book. But I liked the movie, and I think it was because of casting. I think the acting was really good.
And you like the book?
I do, yes.
How much do you like the book?
It's like in my top five favorite books of all time. And I actually hadn't read it in a really long time, like maybe since I was 14 or something. Mm-hmm. And I've just been saying it's like one of my favorite books. Uh-huh. And then I read it again like a month ago, and I was like, yeah, it's still one of my favorite books. So I think I want to say that I like the movie, and I think that's specifically because I thought it was really well cast and well acted for what the actors had to, the material they had mm-hmm. to work with.
Well, and I would agree with that sentiment that it seems that we are all sharing, where there was a lot of stuff left out mm-hmm. of the movie from the book. And full disclosure, I mean, I have read the book, but I read the book nearly, like, what, 8 years ago? Something yeah. like that. And I intentionally chose not to read it again because I felt almost like Orson Scott Card's sentiment about the movie, that it could never really be mm-hmm. made into a good movie.
Yeah.
And I'm pleasantly surprised by the fact that I thought it was a good movie. Not a great movie. It was really fast. they kind of jump from thing to thing. I don't really think they, if you didn't read the book, I don't think you understood like the quickness in which he moved through battle school and other things like that and got to the final end game. Mm-hmm. And as an aside, I want to say that at any point we could be delving into spoilers, so don't worry about spoiling anything. Okay. Go ahead and toss it out there, both for y'all and for anyone listening. You know, if we spoil anything from here on out, you've been warned. But, you know, so they get to the end quicker than I wanted to. The movie was only about an hour and a half long, and with most movies today being 2 to 2.5 hours, I really thought if they would have just spent an extra half hour developing the relationships between
anybody.
Okay,
how about that?
Fair enough.
Good point.
You know, fair enough. Then, or you know, I mean, I love the part where he was in the battle school itself. I wanted to see more of that. It seemed like I went in, I won one battle, and all of a sudden I'm the best person in the entire world to lead this army. Mm-hmm. It was too fast. But I read the book, so I had a background of what generally was going to happen, so I knew why he was pushed through. But the movie took a book that was over, what, 6 years or so? 6, 8 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 6 years.
I'm looking for confirmations.
Yes.
and narrowed it down to 30 days, more or less. Because there was that counter when Colonel Graf was looking. We're running out of time. Had that counter on the screen.
Oh, yeah.
And so they took a movie that was supposed to develop over 6 years, Ender, learning how to be a commander, mm-hmm. learning how to get people to follow him, you know, over the course of his development, and took that in 30 days.
That's interesting because I really don't remember any sense of time at all. Like, how fast some of that stuff was happening. Like,
just fast?
Yeah, I felt like almost like, oh, we're jumping in time like months uh-huh. ahead or like a year ahead or something like that. So I did not really get a very clear sense of like when or how fast any of it was happening. So I'm glad you reminded me of that because, yeah, they did put that up there.
Yeah, I didn't even catch that in the movie. I saw it, but it just I still had in the back of my mind that these years were mm-hmm. passing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I kind of felt the same way. I felt like it was jumping all over the place. And I was very thankful to have read the book. But I feel like that a lot with a lot of books that are made into movies. Mm-hmm. I'm really glad I read the book and I appreciate the movie because of the book. And like my husband went to the movie with me and he had not read the book and was struggling to stay awake, which granted it's not really his topic okay. or type of movie, but we left and he was like, I don't know what was going on. I was lost.
Yeah.
Things blew up.
Yeah.
People got punched.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you were saying, Arian, like, it felt long to you mm-hmm. already. I almost think that, I feel like it could have been longer, but I think that it would only have worked if they were developing some of those relationships. Because yeah. I think those stories were compelling enough that you would actually be drawn into that instead of feeling like you're rushed from one scene to another mm-hmm. simply to get to the surprise ending or whatever, yeah. you know? But, so I feel like it could have been longer if they had chosen to develop some of the really good relationships. And I said nothing was developed, but I feel like Petra and Ender was developed, which is the only relationship that wasn't
developed in the book.
So, yeah, thanks for that, film people.
I'm really glad they didn't go any further with yeah. that relationship, though. I was thinking, oh, they're going to kiss by the end of the book, or by the end of the movie. And I was glad that they
mm-hmm.
right.
cut that off. But they did allude to it quite a bit.
Yeah.
So.
Well, there's only like 10 or something, so, you know, people don't kiss when they're 10, so I hear. That's what people always told me when I was 10.
Maybe you didn't kiss when you were 10.
Oh.
Now, I really think that you were talking about how you, like I said, it was kind of long and how it could have been longer. I really think it would have been a great book to be split, or a great book to be split into multiple movies.
Yes.
Like 2 or 3 movies. Mm-hmm. And then they could have really developed some of those relationships. They could have put more about Valentine and Peter in there, which I thought was pretty important.
Yeah.
And that was left out. So.
No, I completely agree with that. I think the fact that, I mean, as long as we're talking about the difference between, or differences between the book and the movie,
mm-hmm.
If I only watch the movie, don't really understand kind of where Ender's come from and the things that he's had to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing what happens in the book, knowing his family structure, knowing the differences, you know, in Peter and Valentine, and how he's kind of like the right down the middle of both those people and the struggle to stay right down the middle, I felt like I missed something. Just thematically, and understanding who Ender was and why he makes the decisions he does. But I guess in general, that makes me want to ask, are there any, or is it possible to make a good movie or good adaptation where reading the book isn't always better? And I purposely asked that question to what I assume is a biased panel.
I think it is possible to make a good adaptation, but I made a list of all these adaptations that I really, really like a lot. The movies that I really like a lot. And every single one, sure, I've got a whole list of them here. Whole list of them.
I don't want to derail your thought necessarily. Yeah. I just thought it'd be cool to,
sure,
because lots of people don't really even think that some of these movies that they're watching come from actual books.
Mm-hmm. The Princess Bride, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Empire of the Sun, The Pride and Prejudice.
they made a book out of that.
I thought Breakfast at Tiffany's was a good adaptation. Rebecca, The Hitchhiker, Rebecca, Jaws, Jurassic Park, To Kill a Mockingbird. I like The Pelican Brief, Les Mis. This little thing called the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I don't know if anybody knows what that is. Uh-huh. But all of those, I realized that that one, the book and the movie didn't outweigh each other. That I loved both of them for some reason. And so I think when it's achieved good adaptation status is when it is valuable for itself. The film is valuable for itself. Yeah. And I wrote, we can just kind of flesh that out later. I wrote a bunch about, things that I think make good adaptations and why. But, I found that, The Princess Bride is a great example because I feel like I love the book so much. And it is one of these adaptations that is really, really different from the movie, but it's almost like they're not the same thing to me. I love The Princess Bride, the movie, and I love the book, and I love them for completely different reasons. So I wouldn't put Ender's Game in that category. I would put Ender's Game in the same category as, I think, the first Hunger Games movie for me. I like the first Hunger Games movie, and I like the books a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like if I had not read the book, I would not have appreciated the movie as much. And so, to me, it didn't stand alone. Like, it needed the story of the book to kind of supplement that. Because the book, Hunger Games, not to get too much into it, but the book is very internal, and they didn't really do a lot of that with Katniss in the movie, and so... So I liked the movie because I knew what was going on. I knew her motivations and all this backstory. And I went with a bunch of people who hadn't read the book. And they were all kind of like, okay, that was fine. But, you know, it wasn't the most awesome movie. And
I think that's exactly what I said.
Yeah. So I feel similarly, I think, to Ender's Game. I think I liked the movie more because I knew all the backstory.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't
know. Well, and what you're saying about being mostly, in the character's head. Mm-hmm. That was Orson Scott Card's biggest
misgiving about.
Yeah, basically about it being able to be, because he's like so much of the book is in Ender's head, you know, or is in his internalization of things. That
I remember what I was going to say before I started this train of thought. I agree about the multiple movie thing. I was thinking about I started putting some miniseries on here, mostly Dickens books that have been turned into miniseries that are really good. And I was like, man, Ender's Game would have made a great miniseries. Yeah. They could have really done well with that. But yeah, as a single movie, that's exactly why I think it wouldn't work, is because Orson Scott Card was right about his own work. Mm-hmm. Think about that.
Well, but you think, if you're talking miniseries, you're talking about a much lower budget. And if you're talking about much lower budget, things that brought the battle room to life, or the final in-game control room. Mm-hmm. Those scenes were like, visually really nice.
Yeah.
Not like sci-fi channel graphics, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if they could have done that in a miniseries. I think they could have made... And actually, Gavin Hood, the director of this film, talked about how he was trying to get the funding to make Ender's Game and Ender's Shadow at the same time.
Hmm.
So he'd have all the people there. Mm-hmm. But they were so uncertain if the movie would make enough money to warrant the other one. And since they weren't sure if Ender's Game by itself would make enough money, they weren't going to, you know, bankroll
mm-hmm.
the other one. Which is what the problem when you start getting books adapted, because the first one comes out and they haven't made the second one yet. You know, this is what's happened with the Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, we got one and it came kind of on the heels of Lord of the Rings. And we were like, no, we realize this can be done much better.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and so people just didn't go see it. This happened to, I think, the Golden Compass. Mm-hmm. None of the other Golden Compass movies have been made because of the negative kind of reaction to...
Compass?
Compass?
Compass? The Golden Compass?
The Golden Compass?
Continue.
Yes, thank you. Heckles. So, I mean, so that's one of my saddest kind of lamentations about the adaptation genre in general, because I feel there are ways to make some of these books, like some books really lend themselves to being massive on-screen blockbuster type stories that are told. I mean, I think Lord of the Rings is a great example as, you know, changed as it was in parts. You know, that was made to be this epic 3-part movie series. But if you can't guarantee that it's going to make enough money, then it's not going to get made. And one of my only gripes with the film industry is the fact that it's all money driven. But then if it wasn't, then no one's going to make any money and no one would make it. Cause unfortunately people just most of the time don't appreciate art for art's sake.
Yeah.
So, but I've derailed us a little bit because I want to know what you think. Like, since you are self-admitted not a movie person per se, I would automatically assume that you're way more into almost every single book that you've ever read than movie that you've seen.
Yes.
I mean, has anything come close, or like, what are the elements that can make that translate?
I will first say that I agree with Laura about the Hunger Games and Ender's Game being very similar.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because the story is told in first person. You're inside their head. And so it's really hard to express or to show all of those things or the feelings of the main character if, you know, it's in a movie format and they don't figure out a way to, like, get you inside that person's head. So that was my gripe with the Hunger Games is that, you know, I wouldn't have enjoyed it nearly as much if I hadn't read the book. And Ender's Game was, you know, the same. I think it was confusing for people who had not read the book because you didn't really know what Ender was thinking or what was going on in his head. But I will say, as far as books being made into movies, that I really... I enjoy both of them equally, usually. If I like the book, then there's usually something I liked about the movie. But I'm not one of those people who goes into the movie theater and is like, and watches the movie and says, oh my gosh, they completely like changed this from the book. Right. And I am so angry about this. Now, granted, if they completely change something that was very important, then I might be.
The entirety of World War Z? So that's been seen World War Z. It's like the honest trailer is like World War Z, where the only thing they kept from the book is the title or like the font or something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen that, but you know, like very like different type of movie adaptation. But My Sister's Keeper in that book, spoiler alert if you ever read it, the one person dies and in the movie they have her sister die. Like they switch it around and it is
infuriating.
It's very frustrating. So, yeah, I don't like that. But, like, the first thing that comes to my mind is the Harry Potter books and movies. The first few books that were made into movies, the movies were kind of slow.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like it was because they tried to fit everything from these big books into the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I enjoyed them because I enjoyed the books. But as the movies progressed, I think they kind of figured out, well, we, and the books are getting larger too, mm-hmm. they kind of figured out we can't fit all of this into a movie. So they picked the parts that were important, and they made an adaptation for film that turned out to be really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if y'all have seen all of those, but, mm-hmm. you know, like the... A lot of people agree that the later ones are much better than mm-hmm. the ones in the beginning. So I think that they're both really important. I don't think you can take every single element from the book and put it into the movie because you're just... It's not going to be the same.
Right.
It's a different format and a different type of art. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I really enjoy... Typically, I really enjoy elements from both.
I was actually... That reminds me of a conversation I was having with this group of artists that I gather with. We were talking about, like, collaboration on art.
Mm-hmm.
And as an artist, what kind of collaboration do you find respectful or appropriate, and what kinds do you not?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody pretty much agreed that nobody wanted to have a collaboration in which somebody pretty much messed with their art. But if they created something... like around that piece or in response to that piece that was just that highlighted what was important to them about that. It was really, that is really just a response to somebody else's piece, that you're not changing it or messing with it. You're just responding to it. That, that pretty much people across the board felt that that was like an honor, that it was respectful.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that way about adaptations. I wrote that down, that, the adaptations I like are the ones that are humble and respectful of the original work.
Yeah.
And like you were saying about that, what, My Sister's Keeper?
Uh-huh.
That doesn't seem very respectful of the story. And so that kind of thing, I think, general audience picks up on. Like, oh, well, they thought they were better than the book, or mm-hmm. they could do something better than the book or whatever. And I think that's why I liked the casting of Ender's Game so much, is I felt like they were respectful of those characters as they already were. And I think to some degree, the casting of the Hunger Games too. I mean, mm-hmm. I like Katniss actually in that. I just felt like they weren't trying to create somebody new. They were trying to actually get into the head of that character that Card created. And they were trying to portray that, like purely what that was. And I think that's why I appreciated it. I thought Harrison Ford particularly did a great job in Ace of Butterfield. I really liked his Ender.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the reasons on a real world theology podcast that we would spend so much time just talking about the differences in adaptations is that because when you adapt something, we already believe that there are narratives that are resonating with us. There's something in this original story, whether it's a short story, mm-hmm. an essay, a documentary, any kind of thing that's been made, the novel itself. And so when it's adapted, I feel like people in general, there are always the nitpicky, you know, it has to be word yeah. for word or whatever. But I find that most people, myself included, tend to like it or like the adaptation as long as whatever resonated with you from the original work is still held true
exactly
in the adaptation. And I feel like Ender's Game did that as best they could uh-huh. without like taking us inside Ender's head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, when we haven't even really gotten to some of those narrative themes yet, but just the concept that I believe that's one of the main things that, and I don't think people realize that's what they miss, which would be my argument that one day I'll have with those people who are wondering why they like the adaptations or not so much, but that, you know, that there is something there that's either being taken away because uh-huh. if you lose one character and then it's a different one in the movie,
yeah.
there's probably a reason, or there's probably something that happened in between in those interpersonal relationships of the characters that made you resonate with the book. Mm-hmm. And when you take that away, it's not the same narrative. It's yeah. not the same, you know, whatever the issue was, whatever the thing that held you on the, into the book page by page was not there. I mean, it's one of the biggest problems I have with certain changes in Game of Thrones when we watch that series compared to having read the books. The, you know, characters die at different times. They die in different ways. They're not where they're supposed to be. That, you know, makes their character one way for a certain reason. And I find that to be true in a number of things. But anyway, all that to say that adaptation is very important. And moving on from there, before we get to narratives, is one other topic that I think is specific to this film, and that is separating the art from the artist. In this particular case, there has been much to do about words and phrases and sentiment that Orson Scott Card has about his personal beliefs that have infuriated, because they're hot button topics in today's world, an entire segment of the population. And so there's boycotts. You know, apparently boycotts are very popular nowadays. We're boycotting Chick-fil-A for some reason. We're boycotting, you know, this and that. And I don't want to make light of the reasons that people want to boycott things, but in this particular case, I have to wonder, is there really a separation between the artist and its art? Can you go and watch something or read something by someone who has vastly different beliefs than you, and not only maybe vastly different beliefs, but you engaging in their art typically gives them monetary funding,
yeah,
some way. And if that goes to things that you don't believe in, like, where is that line drawn for you guys?
Basically, for me, it's pretty simple. You know, if they have a certain idea or belief, and they're constantly trying to, like, include that in their work, then I'm probably going to have an issue with it. And not just, and I may or may not agree with it, but if there's some idea that, you know, is constantly showing up, and I feel like maybe they're trying to push an agenda or something, then I'm probably not going to read it. But I didn't know much about Orson Scott Card before I read Ender's Game. So I didn't know that he, like, what people were boycotting his movie because he was, he had these certain viewpoints. And I didn't see that in the books, in the book at all. I mean, I didn't see that in the movie, really. There was one comment that was made in the movie that was, like, could have been, but not really. And so, you know, I don't have any problem with reading someone's work, specifically with books, with reading someone's work, as long as there's not some, like, agenda that I feel like is being pushed.
Now, are you saying either positive, or not positive or negative necessarily, but agree or disagree, if it seems like there's an agenda, you're not really interested, even if it's something that, like, oh, I'm really behind that, but they really lay it on thick, I'm not really into
that.
Yeah,
it's
either.
Usually more when it's being laid on really thick that I'm, you know,
not. Well, because then it's not about the story. Yeah. It's not about the art form, you know, or the characters or anything at all. It's just about this person's agenda. And I think, I mean, definitely people's beliefs are showing up in their work. But, I mean, yeah, there's just a difference between something being colored by the way that you see the world versus you manipulating your art form or your characters to make somebody feel or believe something. I mean, a story should make somebody question their beliefs or consider a new set of beliefs just because it's a good, compelling story, not because, you know, people, I don't know, Happy Feet is coming to mind so much right now. I really did not like that movie because I felt like it had a huge agenda. Yeah. But, like that, basically. But I hope that we can read and experience people's art who have different beliefs than us. I mean, I want that for myself because I think that art is one of the primary ways that we learn and grow as people. And so I was thinking about that a lot when I was, like, reading people's responses to Card's work, because he has said some things that, yeah, that I don't agree with and that I feel are, anyway, maybe we shouldn't get into that. But
go wherever you'd like.
But it's not in his work. And I was really glad to stumble across this blog post that I hope you're putting in the show notes, the one that I emailed, where it was really the story of this guy who, as a teenager, encountered Ender's Game and he's a Muslim, and he was, like, living in Kansas or something, and he was so, so separated from his culture, his religion. I mean, I think he maybe knew one other Muslim kid, and so he read Ender's Game, and in a society, in a community that didn't value his religious beliefs and didn't paint a very good picture of mm-hmm. people that believe the same thing, there's a character, Alay or Alai, in Ender's Game that is Ender's first friend. He's very compassionate. He's incredibly intelligent. And he's Muslim, and he is the first person who really offers any kind of love and compassion to Ender. Mm-hmm. And when this guy read that, he felt affirmed in what he believed. And Orson Scott Card did that for him. And he actually was writing letters to Card mm-hmm. about how he made him feel. And Card was responding in a really positive way. And it was interesting to me because that happened in the art, even, you know, maybe if Card wasn't meaning to do that specifically for Muslims, but then he also goes on to talk about how he's watched Card in the media and seen how he's actually become a different person than the man that he felt wrote him letters when mm-hmm. he was a kid. So that's a really interesting article worth reading. But I don't know this for sure, I'm assuming, but I'm pretty sure that cast of people, Ben Kingsley, Harrison Ford, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure they don't believe what Orson Scott Card is saying in the media. And yet they felt like the project was worth being a part mm-hmm. of and doing well. And so I think that it is possible to divorce those things. And I think it's just that lies in our own judgment, you know, to be able to be wise enough to read something and to say, I'm going to take this, I'm going to leave this, you know, and to find value in something. I mean, that's what your podcast is about, to find value in something because it has, you know, the image of Christ in it somewhere, you know. Anyway.
Suddenly you know so much about the podcast. What do you know? Who do you hang out with?
I've got the inside track, my friends.
Well, I'll say this too. I guess anything that I ever would create, I would hope that someone would not hear my personal beliefs and automatically dismiss my art.
Right.
I think, Arian, you've made a really good point, because if my art isn't really art, if it's really just a medium for me to push my opinions, mm-hmm. then I think we can be a little harsher on it. I personally really, really enjoy listening and reading and just engaging with people who disagree with me. Mm-hmm. So I actually kind of, it would have been great for me to have read a book that possessed some of his kind of vitriol against certain types mm-hmm. of people, or certain types of lifestyles, because I would have loved to have him justify characters or have characters who try to come out on one side or the other. Because I think one of the best things to, when I read books, very rarely, honestly, but most of
all, disclosure.
Yeah, full disclosure.
This is not a book podcast.
much more accurately, when I watch TV shows or I watch movies, I love to know where the artist or the writer, the director, whoever's, you know, the people that are responsible for making this. I think they have some say in the direction of the art, and I love to know where they're coming from. Especially if it's different from me, because one of my favorite things is watching people have to write from a different point of view. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, I'm a Christian and I'm having to write non-Christian characters, or I'm a non-Christian and I have to write Christian characters, or you know, I'm a
girl writing a boy.
Yeah, I'm a girl writing a boy. I'm a homosexual trying to write straight people trying to write homosexual dialogue. Like, I think watching them interact through their characters, the arguments that they make their characters makes, actually tells you a lot about what they think and how they formulated their own argument. And I feel like we could all learn a lot more from that. But saying that, I also want to point out that it's totally understandable, though maybe futile in today's world, to think that you cannot ever give any of your money or support or time to something that you don't agree with. I mean, probably all the clothes we wear, you know, the things we buy, the places we live, the time, you know. You know, there is no way to live 100%. Well, there is probably some way to live 100%, you know.
Sometimes it's not about eradicating that completely from your life, but it's about making a choice to do that so that you're bringing it to the attention of other people. And I think that's totally valid. I mean, I totally think that if you feel like Orson Scott Card is putting his money, his personal money, towards things that you really disagree with, then it is completely your right not to do that, and even commendable, you know, for you to stand on your own beliefs and to say that you're not going to contribute to that. But I mean, that's just really that I think is separate from the story Ender's Game, the book Ender's Game.
In this particular case,
And also, I think I just want to say that I think it's very ironic that that people are boycotting Orson Scott Card because he's being very exclusive about certain groups of people, when Ender's Game has been a book that has been acclaimed to be, to connect with people, because it's about loneliness. It's about being cut off from community, and and a really clear portrayal of what that does to a person and how important community is. And it actually explores a lot of the themes that Card is, seems to be ignoring right now. So I just find the story to be valuable, no matter what Card says he believes right now.
Yeah, that is interesting. I forget that this book was written how many years
ago? Almost 30 years ago.
Yeah, that makes me feel old, because that was right around the time I was born. I know, I was about to say.
30 years ago. You youngins. Not that I was that old. But.
Yeah, but it is, I mean, obviously his beliefs can change over time, but it, it is kind of interesting that, you know, Ender's Game is the book that it is, and then he is kind of saying some, you know, things that maybe don't, wouldn't make me think that he wrote that book, you know? So I guess your ideas and beliefs can change.
Well, but he is writing a book about an imperfect future, and maybe it's because people are okay with those things that we have an imperfect future. That's his his devil's advocate.
Okay, yeah.
I'm not saying he's actually saying that. I'm trying to think of any reason that he would write something that's so distant from what his words are. But, okay, so we've talked a lot about kind of things that surround adaptation, things that surround art and artists, but I actually kind of want to dive into the narrative itself, now, or the actual story. I think one of the easiest things to pull away from this movie, even though I don't think it's probably the most accurate thematically, is this concept that Ender himself is a Christ-like figure. And I almost feel that this is because in today's culture, people have such a, I guess, a limited amount of time to really process what they just saw. It's either like, was he a Christ-like figure? Well, then there's nothing redeeming about the movie. You know, like, they have to have a Christ-like figure, or there's, like, people really rarely equate, like, justice or mercy or grace with things that they see. You know, they almost always are like, was there some dude who gave himself up for everybody? Okay, cool. Then that's totally, you know, I totally see where this movie's going. But to be fair to people who did see this, I would say that there's a list of things that make that applicable, but not necessarily the most important thing, because Ender's a son born with hope to bring salvation to humankind. I mean, specifically, they got permission to have a kid that would hopefully be the person that they needed to save mankind. He is set apart because, though he is human, he obviously has knowledge that transcends the ordinary. It's that separation that causes those who look to him for salvation to love him, and those who are threatened by his genius to hate him. So he's polarizing. Through his time at battle school, he earns followers, like devoted followers. Some would call those disciples, you know, try to learn from him and, you know, imitate him. They submit themselves to his authority and tutelage. But I think that's kind of, you know, I think we just really described, like, a strong leader.
Yeah.
I mean, like, when either of y'all were reading the book or watching the movie, I mean, like, did this ever come to the front of your mind? Did you ever see him as like a Christ-like figure that is going on like a long diatribe for y'all to both be like, no?
No, I didn't.
Well, and if not, why not? I mean, like, why does he not fit the bill?
I mean, in the beginning, definitely, it kind of seems like it could be going in that direction, just like you said. But, you know, at the end, he's completely destroying the buggers or the Formics, whatever you want to call it. So, you know, I don't really feel like that's very passionate or, you know, like, not a very loving thing. But, like you were saying, I don't think that it... I mean, I do think that it has very redeeming qualities, the book and the movie, both. Even though I don't really see him as a Christ-like figure, I see him as a person who struggles and, like, wants to figure out kind of who he is and what he believes and is working through those struggles and, you know, finally comes to the point where he is like, wow, I've done something horrible. What am I going to do? Like, how am I going to change and move in a different direction because of this? And I think that's tells a lot about human nature. That tells a lot about humans in general. And so I enjoy books that do that. I'm not necessarily, like, when I read stories, I don't know that I ever, I can't even think of a book where I see a Christ-like figure besides, like, Aslan. Yeah. In
The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I guess the Bible.
You know? Yeah, in the Bible. But, like, other than that, I don't know that I've read any where I just think, wow, that's a Christ-like figure. Mm-hmm. Almost all the books I read have very redeeming qualities, but or redeeming ideas, but not necessarily the... And maybe I just haven't read enough books, but...
I don't have a comprehensive list of the things that you've read, but I feel like based on word of mouth alone, that's probably not the case.
Yeah, I've read a good number, but I still am missing a lot.
There's so many. It's overwhelming.
It is overwhelming.
I never thought about Ender as a Christ-like figure until I started reading some of the reviews of the movie. Mm-hmm. And people were saying that. I think essentially because his choice in the end is violence over peace. That's one thing. And because there are two times when he actually kills two boys, which there's a review that pointed out that they were only wounded in the movie, which kind of took away some of the gravity of what, you know, Ender's capable of. He could have chosen to allow himself to just get beaten by these guys, but he chose violence instead. And I think that is probably one of the biggest reasons why I don't see him as a Christ-like figure. And also because he beats the Formics not because he has in mind all of humanity that he wants to save from this evil force. If he's thinking of anyone at all, it might be Valentine. Because she kind of appealed to him to kind of preserve her life, you know, and go back to battle school. But I think ultimately Ender has some understandably selfish goals, which is that he wants to be accepted. He wants to be included. He wants to be loved. And this just happens to be playing the games well, doing what people are asking of him just happens to be the only path that's before him. But then when that was put in front of me to think about Ender as a Christ-like figure, there is one way that I see him as a Christ-like figure. I'm going to read something that I wrote about that.
I would love to hear that.
All right. I said, the book seems to suggest... by saying that Ender is the best, the savior, the perfect balance between Peter, the violent, and Valentine, the compassionate, that there has to be a balance of peace and war within us. We can't be too violent all the time because we put ourselves in danger of one another. So that's why they didn't choose Peter to go be the commander. The world's too hard for us to be soft and tender all the time, which I would equate with Christ. Mm-hmm. And Valentine is like that. That's why she wasn't chosen. So we have to control the violence. We can adapt it. We can control it. We can mold it to our purposes. But then the film shows us, I think that's Graf's perspective, that he can use Ender, who's a good balance, and he can mold that inherent violence in him for a good purpose. But the film shows us that we're wrong. Like Graf, we're building these assumptions on things that aren't true, even though that's all the information we have. He's using Ender's propensity for violence against a threat that is actually not a threat. The buggers aren't really a threat. But mm-hmm. he's using all the information that he, you know, this fallible human has. There's a third way that we can't see, and actually Ender can see the third way. But because he's really young, because the adults around him are manipulating his path, the adults around him actually do not create an environment where he can be the best that he is. Because the best that Ender is somebody who's really perceptive, who can see into the heart of even his enemy and understand them. But they manipulate that for their own purposes, which just ends up doing something that is totally misinterpreted. They misinterpret the enemy. But if they had let Ender be the best that Ender could be, if they let him see this third way, end of the book shows us that he could have communicated with the Formics and he could have brokered peace.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, I see him as a Christ-like figure because we in the world see things very black and white, that mm-hmm. it's got to be either this way or this way. But typically, I have seen in Scripture that Christ is always choosing a third way that just blows our minds.
Yeah, actually, when you were just reading that, I didn't know if you were actually going to go all the way to that point, but that's what I was thinking. Because I feel like most people think it's either you have to be aggressive and violent or you have to be completely compassionate. And if we want to see him as a Christ-like figure, one of the ways that I think he best represents that, even though he was obviously manipulated and mm-hmm. used for a different ends, he's like, no, it's not, you know, black or white. It's a third way, a way that transcends both those ways. Because sometimes there is a time to defend yourself. And sometimes there is a time to listen. You know, it's not either or, it's mm-hmm. both and all. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons that, especially the book, and this is a shortcoming of the movie, that the book being so much in Ender's head, having to wrestle with those two things is so compelling to the reader.
Right.
And what I wanted to be compelling to the viewer, but I feel like they missed out on. And you actually hit on something that I wanted to move to as well. Let's just hit the main quote, and I'll go ahead and read it. It says, "In the moment when I truly understand my enemy, understand him well enough to defeat him, then in that very moment, I also love him. And then in that very moment, when I love them, I destroy them. I make it impossible for them to ever hurt me again." And what I see here is not only is he a third way, but he's also big picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think one of the problems that I have, like I really, as a younger guy, I wanted to be a fan of Mazer Rackham, mm-hmm. you know, like the guy who came in and he's like hero
kicked
forever.
Everyone's butt.
Yeah, that's right. He came in and cleaned house. Oh, we're Colonel Graf. I'm just doing what it takes to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if we take that and relate it to our own lives, we often are just trying to like do one thing we're doing things that are hopefully affecting eternity, but not fighting on an eternal kind of battlefield. Mm-hmm. And like, that's most of the people's problem. They have to try to get to lead this army. You have a whole bunch of people who are good at like winning battles, you know, like Bonzo is really good at winning a battle. But like he can't win the war, you know. His skill set for the big picture is weak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like when you saw that flash right up there at the beginning of the movie, I mean, like did that give you like a direction where you thought the movie would head, or like did this quote resonate for you at all? Because I felt like the movie put it out there like it was going to be the theme, like mm-hmm. it was going to be the thing. Do you feel like the movie moved in that direction?
I feel like I often, when I see movies that have been made from books, I get them all mixed up. And I'm like, what was actually in the movie and what was right. in the book? Let's see if I can remember that. I mean, I do, it was obviously a prominent theme in the book, too. Mm-hmm. And so when it showed up on the screen, I was like, oh, okay. That kind of gave me hope that we were going to kind of keep the same ideas. Mm-hmm. Because that is, even though I wasn't a huge fan of the book, I love that theme mm-hmm. And kind of how that shaped the book and the movie. But, yeah, I think that... that is a very important theme, and I think it went throughout the movie more so in the book.
Yeah,
but you know, as I'm trying to separate the two, I think that it was definitely a theme in the movie.
So they actually, I did feel like they kept putting on a small scale and making it larger and larger and larger.
Yeah.
And I feel, because, you know, at the beginning he has the fight that he has to win, and not just win for that fight, but win for all time. And then he has to take Bonzo outside and say, like, look, we're going to both win this way. Let's look at the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And then he escalates from battle school and battle school to the actual battle, you know, and then now he's trying to win again with the Formix, you know, he's like, I'm going to do what I can, mm-hmm. what is right. I'm looking at the bigger picture because you shouldn't be eradicated, things like that. And I think if we just continue to draw that out, I don't want to like sermonize, I guess, but like, to me, when I see this, I see what really sets him apart. It's why he's so enviable, and why we all want to be Ender. We want to be able to see the bigger picture. And I think if we correlate that to the Christian life, like, I always want to do one more nice thing because I'm hoping it's going to ensure my eternity. Yeah. Or I'm going to, you know, feed the hungry. It's going to ensure my eternity. But those things don't ensure my eternity. I have to have someone who can fight a battle on an eternal scale to affect eternity. And I actually, you know, I wrote a post about this. I was fortunate enough to have someone want to hear my thoughts more than just on the podcast. And just taking that to its full extent, you know, if we believe that there is an eternal battleground or there is an eternity, if we have an outlook that says we're not just here, because what I saw from Colonel Graf and I saw from Maser Rackham is like, this is all we have. We mm-hmm. have to defend our life mm-hmm. now. If we believe in a world that is beyond the temporary, then we have to plan for the non-temporary. And I feel like that was the difference between, and Ender was like, these are going to go on forever. This is a species. They're going to have children, and their children are going to have children. And we've denied that, you know? So.
And exactly what you're saying, I think if you don't believe that there's something beyond what we have here, then Graf's position makes absolute sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the reasons why I love the characters in general in this book, is because I feel like Card almost does that with every character, that we can understand through Ender's eyes. We get to see the heart of every character. We even get to see the heart of Bonzo, and that there's a lot of family expectation that makes him so insecure, and that insecurity comes out in anger. But, I mean, even Graf fully understands Ender, so much so that he's able to destroy Ender, and he loves Ender. I mean, he does the same thing that Ender's doing. Anyway, that's like off topic, but, yeah, I am totally on board with, because in one sense, I get him. I can feel that sense of urgency. You know, he mm-hmm. keeps saying, why do I care about destroying the life of one boy if everything is going to go up in flames?
Yeah.
And that argument makes complete sense. But we don't believe that this is all. And so we have to think about things, like you said, with an eternal perspective. And he actually chooses Ender because he sees that Ender can see a third way, And yet, he doesn't allow Ender to see that. He actually manipulates him to become... He pretty much turns him into Peter.
Yeah.
Instead of letting him just be Ender.
Or at least he tricks him into being Peter.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a very interesting thought that, you know, that Graft could not see, you know, the bigger picture. You know, he's not thinking eternally. And it's obvious that he's not thinking eternally because he is saying, I'm okay with, you know, destroying this boy and so that we can save Earth, so we can save their world.
Yeah, logically, mathematically.
Yeah, it makes sense. And even when he said that in the movie, I was like, that would be a hard decision to make. Right. You know, like, it's even compelling for me. I'm sitting there thinking about it. And then, you know, as you were talking about, you know, him not having that third perspective, it makes a lot of sense where he was coming from. And, like, I actually like him a little bit more now, just knowing where he kind of comes from, where he's coming from.
I mean, I think Harrison Ford really does a great job of showing that he is really struggling with having to make that decision, but even more so in the book. I mean, he gains a lot of weight at some point, and then he loses a lot of weight and looks sickly. So it just shows that he is really stressed, and even physically, he is all out of whack because he's the one that this decision comes down to. He's having to make this decision for the whole world, and it's a really hard thing to do. I really liked in the movie, is her name Viola Davis?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, not in the movie, but her character is.
She played Anderson, and I liked... I don't think I really got this in the book. Maybe this is the way they changed it. But she played a psychologist or psychiatrist that was analyzing the children. And she actually was very concerned for Ender and his well-being. And there's one point where she resigns. And Graf pushes back against that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But then he eventually says, you're right. You know, you really have no place here because we can't coddle them or we can't protect them. And she goes away. And that, to me, was just a huge picture of just kind of a final nail in Ender's coffin, that we're sending away the only person that's going to have compassion on you. I thought that was I thought their interactions with each other were really good, too. What was the question?
Well,
the original question.
Yeah.
Well, I'll say this to hopefully wrap that section up, that one of my favorite things about any kind of story, whether I agree with the character or not, whether they're likable or not, it's something that we'll probably talk about in Thor, but like when a character is that character and he doesn't deviate from his worldview just because it's convenient or it wraps the story with a bow. And the reason I mentioned Thor is because, you know, eventually we're going to talk about Loki, like, just always being bad. And that's just who he, I mean, based on his outlook, that's what he does, you know, and it would be much simpler. It would, like I said, wrap things up with a much prettier bow if Colonel Graf didn't believe the things he believed, or Maser Rackham, if they didn't fully believe in the continuance of their species over another, or at the cost, or at the whatever of another. But they do, and they don't change, because there's never really any reason for them to change.
Yeah.
You know, they've witnessed, they've experienced things, and because of those, they react in a way that I would expect those characters to react. And so even though, you know, they end up kind of being the bad guys, you know, because they participate in genocide or xenocide or however you want to, you know, categorize it. That's who they are. And that's what they believe. And so...
And they're actually honorable men within that belief system, I think.
Yeah. I mean, not in, I think, our belief system.
Right.
But... In the, you know, they are true to their own beliefs. And, you know, I don't necessarily want to make a case for, you know, moral relativism, but at least I can understand when someone acts out the things, or actually it means a lot more to me. This goes back to earlier saying, like, I like talking to people I disagree with. As long as, you know, your actions follow the words and stuff like that, that's really compelling to me. Which is why I think it's really hard to write people that you don't write characters or believe characters that disagree with the actual artist. So
I wrote down this thought on that subject. I said, it only makes sense to me that you would seek peace at personal cost if you believe there was something greater than the impermanent, the now. So it only, and I don't really know what Ender, it's not really discussed what Ender believes in terms of why he would feel compassion for this species or why he would seek peace. But just in terms of that idea, like contrasting that ideology to Graf and Rackham's, they really have no reason. If they only believe that the impermanent is all that they have, they really have no reason to put their own life on the line for somebody else.
And more so that I think by the end of the movie, your average moviegoer, which probably, at least in this country, probably believes in the self-preservation
above
everything else, they are actually probably against Graf at the end. They're like, oh, well, what he was doing was bad.
Yeah.
And they can't, you know, disassociate their own beliefs from that, even though, which is, you know, one of the reasons we really, really kind of try to nail this whole, you know, entertainment's not mindless, you know, think about what you're watching because it's hopefully influencing you. But like that disassociation will always fascinate me. You know, you come, you watch something, you're like, that is totally wrong. I'm gonna go out and completely believe that same way. We are kind of getting to about that time, and I don't want to say that we've hit on every single thing in the movie. We did, like I said, I really wanted to talk about the adaptation stuff. Oh, well, I had Arian here. And because of Orson Scott Card's situation, I wanted to hit on that as well. So we didn't get as much time in the movie, but it moves us into our wrap up, so to speak. So we are at the come on moments in the movie. And I guess we can even include the book as well if you want to do a dual one. So either you ladies first. What kind of didn't sit well with you? What was just not doing it for you?
I'm kind of contradicting myself a little here, but I really just had, and I've said this, you know, earlier, but I really just had a hard time with, for one, I thought that it was too long, but at the same time, I thought that it didn't really go in as deep as I wanted to. So that's why I feel like I'm contradicting myself. But
It was too long for what they gave you.
Yes, it was too long for what they gave us. And I would love to have seen more about just the relationships, especially bringing Valentine and Peter. That was the main thing that I was like, really? You did not put Valentine? I mean, they're in there, but barely. And you barely see Peter at all. Mm-hmm. And I thought he was really important to see the contrast from Valentine. But
well, without the development of Valentine, most of her scenes in the movie kind of seem fairly hollow. Was that just me?
Oh, no.
Yeah. I mean, like, you're like, oh, why does she have so much sway? Why does Ender care so much about, you know, being compassionate towards her?
Yeah.
I mean, anyway.
Yeah. I mean, mine is a specific scene, but it's for that reason. I mean, I just love in the first half of the book how there's a special situation for every single relationship that Ender ends up in with a main character. There's something that happens and he, through his compassion or his intelligence or whatever, he is able to create a relationship or a connection with that person and make them want to follow him when he's the youngest in his class. He's really a nobody and everyone has been set up to really hate him by the teachers. But he wins them over and it's just brilliant the way that he does that. And also just makes him so lovable that he, above all things, he is pursuing relationship with people that he wants to be loved and he wants to just laugh with people and play with people and have that relationship. So one scene that really drove that home to me, I think I literally said in my head, come on, in the theater, was when Dap is taking him to his first quarters as a commander of a, what do they call him? army? Did they call it army?
Yeah, the Squadron? Army. The, yeah. The Dragon Army?
Yeah, when he's become the commander of Dragon Army, he takes him to his quarters, and Ender says, do you think they'll follow me? And Dap is like, basically like, oh yeah, like you're the greatest. And I was like, why? Why do you think he's the greatest? What has he done?
Yeah.
And I just, oh my goodness. That was just an example of how flat those relationships were. And I felt the same thing with him and Bean. Like, Bean was such a jerk to him on the shuttle or whatever. And just with, like, a sentence, he suddenly like, oh yeah, I'm your best friend.
Okay, it's cool, guys.
Yeah. So, anyway, those kinds of things were really disappointing to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I already mentioned, like, the whole sped-up timeline. I don't think it would have been that much harder to kind of time-lapse this over, you know, at least just a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make this last a year instead of 30 days.
Yeah.
Could have used a montage, you know?
Yeah. Battle room montage.
That's right, battle room montage, you know? But I think one thing that... And it's very similar to the Peter Valentine thing. I wanted more things that showed me why Ender became the way he did, like or who he was, and made me really get behind him. And I think for me, one of the things that I could not get out of my head was the fact that, especially in the book, he was isolated. He was like really isolated. Not even like kind of isolated. Not like back of the room isolated, but most of the time kept completely separate, and given way more hurdles to overcome. And the thing was, that wouldn't have been that big of a deal if not in the movie, Colonel Graf takes the time to say, we've got to keep him separate. We've got to isolate him and make him strong and stuff like that. And then basically in the rest of the movie, they don't really show that happening.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, well, if you're going to ignore it, like you're doing like the Valentine Peter thing, just ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But you said it. You put it out there like, we're going to isolate him. Except for the rest of the movie, where we're going to basically have him with people all the time and then promote him, you know. So that was really something that kind of stuck out to me.
Yeah.
But we move from that to our favorite moment, so we can end on a positive note.
My favorite moment was when he starts leading Dragon Army and how he comes in and starts interacting with them in just... It was like a great picture of a leader for me. It wasn't someone that comes in and was like had to show that they were in control. Mm-hmm. He was just a person. And at that moment in the movie, he was a person that I, you know, wanted to follow as well. So I just really like how that specific scene where he's getting all, getting them excited about being part of Dragon Army. It just kind of said a lot about Ender.
I'm starting to realize that I think I like this movie. I said I liked it in the beginning because I just really want to like it.
Yeah.
Because honestly, I think I would see it again, and I would see it again really for like maybe the last 30 or 40 minutes of it. Because I do, I did particularly find that last scene with the Formic Queen to be really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, Asa did a really good job, and it really touched me because I knew that from the book she was kind of in his head and she was communicating with him, and so she knew that it was him who destroyed her entire species. And she even, I loved the way they filmed that, and actually took liberties with that from the book. I mean, he didn't actually encounter a real life Formic in the book, but I love that they put that in there because it gave the Formic the opportunity to, what's the word I'm looking for? To retaliate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And actually reached out in a gesture that seemed dangerous or violent. And instead it chose to actually wipe away a tear from his cheek. And also I love that he presented himself for that. That he knew that what he had done, even if it wasn't intentional, and he was saying, you can kill me if you want, because I just killed your whole race. And not a word of that was spoken. It was just in the CGI and, you know, his performance. And just that picture of the transforming nature of forgiveness, I think really touched me. That, you know, she, the queen or whatever, forgave him. And so... he wanted to spend the rest of his life offering you know, what?
So does this mean the Formic Queen is the Christ-like figure?
Honestly? Can we handle that? A bug is our Christ?
That's not the way. That's not the way the picture was drawn in my Southern Baptist church.
Of an insect,
very on creepy cross. Looking insect
with a beard, yeah. And a robe,
and that she believed in him enough or knew his. She actually knew his soul in a way that nobody else knew his soul because mm-hmm. she was in his head, and knew that he was trustworthy to give this last remaining hope of their race, this egg, you know? So I just think that that's really a compelling picture of, like, what we've seen in our own world, and specifically South Africa comes to mind, and Rwanda, where the beaten down party says, more violence isn't going to stop anything. You know, let's choose forgiveness and compassion and see where that gets us. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, I liked that last bit in the movie, but the more we've talked about the first half, the more I'm just bitterly disappointed.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because I kind of felt the same way about the book and the movie. The first half was really hard for me, mm-hmm. and then once things kind of, like, started coming together, I did enjoy mm-hmm. the second half in both the book and the movie more yeah. than the first half.
So we've gone from Laura really liking, or liking the movie... And Arian hating the movie, well, not hating, but disliking the movie, and y'all have kind of switched.
To a third way?
To a third way.
Yes. Well, it's funny because I feel like there have been other books or movies that I haven't really enjoyed. And then when I sit down and, like, really talk about them with people, I'm like, oh, I like that more than I thought I did. Mm-hmm. So.
And that is perfectly all right.
Yeah.
Because it means you're talking about what you've been ingesting. And that is awesome. Discussion. Yeah. And I guess, mine to kind of not tie a bow on it. I pretend it would, but none. So instead of wonderful pictures of forgiveness or leadership, I've chosen just the general last battle room and like, because I just thought it looked cool.
Yeah.
And like in my mind, you know, like one of the things I like about books is because hypothetically my imagination is better than anything that I could ever visually watch on screen. Hypothetically. But I was like, this is way cooler than I thought it was.
Oh, yeah, that helped me a ton. Seeing, yeah. mm-hmm. I mean, I could see it in my mind somewhat, but I think they did. That is one thing the movie was just great about, is actually helping me picture what I'd been trying to picture, mm-hmm. You know, in my mind, and the last battle scene, and even just the battle room, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. in general, when there's no gravity and how they had to, like, deal with that. I think the movie really helped me see that.
Yeah, that was all. I mean, I think it was one of its stronger moments. Mm-hmm. It did. It capitalized as much as it could mm-hmm. on the fact that it could CG all these really cool things that, you know, they couldn't have done 30 years ago. But at the same time,
I still believe that if they did a miniseries on a smaller budget, it would have been more compelling if they'd gone with the relational side than the visual side. I think that any viewer, almost any viewer, would be on board with a version that was not as visually stunning, because I think the story is that good. I think the characters are that good, and characters mean a lot to me.
Yeah. I agree with that.
But so for all the, like, people with lots of money who are listening to this podcast, I'm not for it.
Laura has no hands.
Anyway, I feel like the movie is so sparse and spread out that if they really wanted to rectify the situation with the same characters, they could actually do mini episodes of Ender, Asa Butterfield as Ender, and, like, how he became friends with these people, you know, like, and they wouldn't have to redo the movie Ender's Game.
No, I think they said that even now, since the movie's done, that the character that played Beans already, like,
oh yeah,
like, way taller and stuff like that. I mean,
yeah,
the movie was filmed like a year ago, at least. I can't remember exactly, mm-hmm. but it's somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, it was mm-hmm. done filming way in the past, and they've been, you know, just editing and.
Well, yeah. That's okay. I didn't care for Bean at all. I didn't care who played him, so get someone else.
I did like him in the book, but I didn't like him so much in the movie.
Yeah. No, because he was flat in the movie.
Once again, they didn't develop the character.
Exactly.
Well, and I'll tell you this,
like a paper doll.
since you just read Ender's Game,
uh-huh.
I would highly recommend Ender's Shadow.
Okay.
Because I think I enjoyed Ender's Shadow more than I did Ender's Game.
Now, is Ender's Shadow the one from Bean's perspective, or is that... Okay.
So it's same story, just Bean's perspective, which I think, once again, I mean, it's all internal character, like, where is this coming from, where is this going? Mm-hmm. And I just think it's... It gives you a lot more insights into how Ender's perceived.
Okay.
And anyway. Yeah. But you probably have a very long reading list. It's kind of like someone come up and be like, you've got to watch this show. And I'm like, yes, yes, I know I have to watch this show. There are only so many hours in the day. And yes. I have a podcast to do. So, is there anything else that y'all would like to throw in there at the end? I mean,
I don't think so.
In like a 30 second big point.
Lake Brant does not look like that.
Lake Brant does not look like that.
I was like, where is Lake Brant?
I want to go to this Lake Brant. Yeah. Yeah. Not
where,
mine.
Where are these Rocky Mountain type things in Greensboro, North Carolina?
Not Greensboro.
Yeah, because for those of you who don't know, like this podcast is recorded in Greensboro, North Carolina. And that is the home of our Orson Scott Card, which he used for the backdrop of like Ender's home and stuff like that. And seeing Ender's lake house at Lake Brant, Greensboro, North Carolina.
It was almost insulting.
Yes. It was a little insulting. I was like, no, not even close. I mean, God, that's beautiful. Lake Brant. I mean, Lake Brant's really nice, but like...
It's not that nice.
It's not like nice, nice.
And they don't mention Greensboro in the movie at all,
no.
do they?
No.
I
think so, no. You know, it's just one of those things, if you read the book, you know, where they technically are, but...
I just couldn't remember if they had mentioned it.
I just thought it was quite hilarious because normally Lake Brant, especially around here, you know, you live on Lake Brant, that's like a new car, but or like, you know, like, or like you got a very nice Lexus, but like Lake Brant in the movie was like, you bought a Bentley, you know, like.
You're going to put that meme in the show notes, right?
Yeah. What, oh, what the?
The Lake Brant meme.
Oh, maybe. I'll think about it. I want to try to keep the podcast meme free. So,
oh,
this is sorry. This is classy.
I'm sorry.
This is classy stuff. You can tell because I'm hosting it. Okay, so that kind of wraps up that. And as always, I love to give the people who spend time coming here, giving the podcast their time, a chance to let people know how they can get a hold of them. If they enjoy listening to you rant and rave about books and adaptations and movies and stuff, if they would like to get a hold of you, follow you, see your work, the things that you do, how could they do that, Laura?
I do such a bad job of this. All right. Let's see if I can remember all my addresses. I'm on Twitter at Laura_Fissel. I have a blog called leavingteaching.blogspot.com, but I don't really post on it very much these days. Most of the writing I do is on working on full-length novels that aren't really available for people to read. But I do talk about what I write really on social media, so Twitter's probably a good place to find me. But the thing that I am probably writing more frequently than anything else that's available to the public is my Whoology segment on Real World Theology's blog. And the third episode, or the third article, should be coming out pretty soon.
That excites me.
Yes.
I love content on Real World Theology. So thank you. And Arian, how can people follow what you do?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Arian Jones.
Ooh, I'm not even sure if I'm following you.
Arian, E-R-I-E-N-N-E, because I always get that question. And also, I write book reviews at fictionfinders.blogspot.com. I'm struggling with that, too. Fictionfinders.blogspot.com. And I do like 3 or 4 reviews a month. And I also have a friend that works on this blog with me, so she writes some reviews, too. We have a decent mix, but I will say I've been reading a lot of young adults, so I have some young adult on there right now, but we have a mix of all different types of books. So, yeah.
But when you say that you write 3 or 4 book reviews a month, that means you're reading 3 or 4 books a month, right? At least.
Yeah, reading more than that.
Yeah.
Now she's just showing off. I mean, minimum.
Okay, so I read 2 a month, but I also listen to audiobooks. So I have multiple books going at a time. And audiobooks when I'm at work and shelving in the library, which is kind of mindless. So I listen to books too. Hmm. So, yeah.
Okay.
Do a mixture.
Okay.
That makes you feel better.
It makes me feel a little bit better. I'm like, I've read 2 books this year. I've read 2 books this year.
That is okay.
This year. Given.
You watched a lot of movies.
I've
watched a lot of movies.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say about my books, I both of them were Game of Thrones books. So, I mean, both of them were like 950 pages. Mm-hmm. So, that's like lots of normal books.
Definitely.
That's lots of normal books.
Very true.
I actually used to think I could not read very well. I mean, not because I was not literate or anything, but like just my attention didn't. And those would be like books that were like 200 pages. And then like once I finished my first Game of Thrones, like 900 page book, I was like,
I can read anything.
I was like, these other books won't take me but a week. I should sit down sometime, whenever. Not now.
And that's
I'm busy.
When it ended.
I'm busy. But the confidence that I could do it, that's what I needed. So now I can brag about something that I do not do. But most importantly, if I will get that information from both these lovely ladies. And if you didn't catch some of that and you don't feel like moving the podcast back about a minute, then all this information will be at the Real World Theology blog, which is at realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, World Theology. You can follow Real World Theology on Twitter at Real World Theo, or you can follow me, which is eerily similar as far as tweeting goes, at Physification. You can also find us on iTunes, this podcast. If you do that, review the show, bump our rankings, and let's get more people involved in the conversation. I just want to thank my guests again for being here and you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember,
the enemy's gate is down.
The enemy's gate is down. Oh, yes. And entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.